Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Small Business Digest Radio. My name is Don Mazzella, and I am your host for a program devoted to identifying strategies and suggestions to help small business managers increase profits, add sales, better manage cash flow, improve employee management, and streamline operations. Our guests are other entrepreneurs and experts offering their solutions to the problems and opportunities facing small business leaders. Our aim in each program is to provide one or two thought-provoking ideas or suggestions. So follow us on Twitter at #2SBDigest or at our website at www.smallbusinessdigest.net. Tonight's program is really going to be unusual. As we all know, medical marijuana, marijuana in general, as both a cure-all for illnesses and for some people's view of life, is now becoming a top issue. One of the things that is happening is that in Colorado and other places, a lot of people are making a lot of money off of medical marijuana. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I'm a member of the board of a nonprofit in New Jersey providing medical marijuana to sick patients. We have the most regulated environment in the country, and it's very difficult to get medical marijuana in my state, but in other states it's easier. We've asked Paul M. Enright to join us tonight. His company does a very interesting thing. It helps individuals and groups of individuals to enter the medical marijuana business, and if it's legal in the state, to sell it to others. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we always start asking, before we get into this subject, and I have to tell you, the switchboard is already lit up with people who are listening in. We always ask our guests a little bit about their own background before we get into the subject at hand. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Paul. I was impressed by your background.
I've spent the last 20 years plus in various industries, all related to publicly traded companies, whether it be mining companies, and in fact, I spent some time CEO of a publicly traded company that was in the marine salvage business. But my background is very keen on the ability to manage and run publicly traded companies. As a resident of Colorado, several years ago, I started headed down the road of getting into the medical marijuana business, and I backed away from it just because I wasn't comfortable with what was going on with the at the time with the federal government. Just as things were relaxing and I started to readjust my focus on the business, I received a phone call from some people that suggested that I team up with a group here that is looking to take their company and take the intellectual property that they control and put it inside of a public company, which in that intellectual property is what it powers River Rock, Colorado, and take that intellectual property and proliferate it to other jurisdictions, whether it be in Colorado itself or some of the other 20 plus states that where it's already legal, and so we launched the company a couple of months ago. In fact, just today the name change was official for the we merged into very clean public shell corporation. We're now known as United Cannabis Corp. Officially as today, trading under the symbol C. NAB, which is sort of an acronym for cannabinoid, and so since then we've just been extremely busy. We're getting a lot of attention, a lot of phone calls. You can imagine there's a tremendous number of people that really desire to get in the business. They've got the capital and the desire, but what they don't have is the wherewithal or know-how, and that's what we bring to the table.
Well, before we go any further, let's make it clear to the audience. Under federal law, the raising and growing and dispensing of marijuana is still illegal, and that whatever you do, you have to have the understanding that you are basically doing something illegal under federal statutes. And but in certain states, Colorado and Oregon being the most wide open, and New Jersey being the most regulated, I think there's seven states now where they've legalized it within the state. And you can't take it, whatever you, legally, you cannot take whatever you buy or whatever you raise and send it across the state line. Am I right on that?
You're mostly right. Now, for our company, as a company, we have a policy, we do not touch the plant. However, we have the entire skill sets and knowledge and know-how and have it set up in a system where if we were to team up with a group out of, take it Canada or Nevada, we would be able to train them very, very well in order for them to replicate the model that we have in Colorado. As far as, bringing in, we can help with staffing, bring in people that have been trained under the River Rock system, and or we just call the same intellectual property that River Rock is using, and then that person would become an employee of our of the company that we participate in the manage of. We're a management and consulting company, so we'll bring in all the staffing, we give them everything they need to be a successful company in the space without us as a company actually touching any cannabis products.
Well, I realize that, but before we get to that, continue on that. Let's talk about if one of our listeners wanted to get into raising, and let's stick with medical marijuana because the FCC rules, et cetera, prevent me from talking about what is essentially an illegal product in most of the states. But let's just talk on that level. What are the things that someone who wants to do it should know? For instance, raising marijuana is not an easy process. What are some of the obstacles to raising marijuana? And by the way, there are over 800 different varieties of marijuana, and within that, certain of those seeds, those strains help one set of medical problems, and other strains help others. What are some of the problems that they face? Can you help us with that, Paul?
Well, sure. Let's start with the fact that, due to the fact that it's been illegal since the early 1930s, if someone has a very strong set of skills in growing it, they were likely doing it where it was in a place where it wasn't legal. So you can imagine that there's not a bunch of master, what I would call people that would be identified as master growers running out there because they didn't, anybody who had the desire, maybe not have acted on it because they didn't want to break the law. But there are those that out there that have, been in the cultivation of cannabis products for many, many years. And just like anything, it's a skill. And there's also a feel to it. You've heard that, there's some people that have green thumbs and there's just some people that don't. And so, go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, you first. I was going to make a joke. I was going to say I'm one of those that doesn't have a green thumb.
And it simply is what it is. So go ahead. Just re-ask that question for me one more time because I want to make sure I give you a good concise answer on that.
Well, there are difficulties in raising marijuana. It has to be done in a certain way. Am I right on that point?
You're correct. I mean, it goes from, in most of it, to be done properly, is done in indoor growing situations, because you only want to grow the female plants, so you don't want to have some outdoor plants where you're have the potential for cross-pollination, and you've got the situation where you have to have controlled lighting. You want to make sure the lighting's controlled, and so that the plant goes through its normal cycles. It's not flowering too early, doing things like that. Nutrients have to be precisely measured. You've got to be make sure you're growing extremely strong plants, health wise, so they're not susceptible to disease, spider mites, permethium, various things that can negatively affect the outcome of the crop. I mean, it's a lot of small nuances, which is as much feel as it is science. And a good master grower can walk into a room and just by seeing what's going on, be able to identify, situations where you might not have unhealthy plants or something going on, and take action quickly to be sure that those plants are, remain in an optimum state of health. And so that takes a relatively long time to be able to develop that skill. So this isn't going out and planting seed in your yard and putting fertilizing on it and mowing your lawn. It's, there is absolutely a science to it, but it's also art as well.
Well, that's one thing. I should also point out that in most states, you can't have an employee with a criminal record.
No, the background checks are extremely thorough.
I can attest to that here in New Jersey. But now let's move forward a little bit. One of the things that I was amazed at, but I shouldn't have been because the illegal, is that if properly done, marijuana dispensing can be an extremely profitable operation, particularly with the high prices now being charged for it. There was a story in today's paper that I read that one advocate saying that if we had more competition, the price would go down. But can you talk a little bit about the financials of medical marijuana and marijuana in general?
Well, well-run operations can be quite profitable, but to also address that, at least half of the dispensing and growing operations in Colorado have gone out of business because they weren't able to be profitable, because they didn't have the skill sets to run their businesses properly. So, there's probably some facilities that do, under $1 million a year with small grows and dispensaries, and I'm guessing, there's facilities out there, getting close to, $70-80 million a year in gross revenue, and sometimes perhaps even more. In some jurisdictions where they plan on limiting the number of licenses that are available, I would see that those numbers could go even higher, just because of the supply and demand.
Well, isn't one of the more difficult parts of this is getting that license? In New Jersey, there's only 6 permitted in the entire state. What do you do in a case? What are some of the obstacles, and quite frankly, how do you help?
Again, you mentioned one of the obstacles. If you've got a criminal background, you're gonna have difficulties. If you're applying for the license and you can't demonstrate the wherewithal to be able to take that license and act upon it by deploying capital to build facilities and have enough capital to operate so your business can attract enough customers to remain in business. I mean, it's just like anything else. I mean, you've got to be financially prepared to do that. So there's a lot to demonstrate to the regulators before they're going to hand you a license.
Well, believe me, I know that. I've talked to some Colorado growers and then some in Oregon, and they all They all say, interesting enough, that their biggest difficulty is attracting customers and getting doctors to prescribe medical marijuana. Can you make a comment on that at all?
I would say that anybody that would go to a doctor, there's quite a few doctors in the Colorado area that certainly provide licenses to worthy patients, which is also known as a red card here. They certainly, you know, they need to demonstrate to the doctor that they've got something going on with them that warrants them to get a red card so they can obtain cannabis-based products to, you know, deal with whatever ailment it is that they're trying to deal with, or ailments for that matter. You know, as an example, there's many, many kids that are now that hold red cards to help them deal with their epilepsy. And there is a mountain of evidence out there, and you can point to Sanjay Gupta's documentary called Weed, where the stories are fantastic and real and being verified by doctors, where you've got kids that are suffering from hundreds of epileptic seizures, you know, a week, to getting on the meds and coming down to one or two a day, or sometimes even less. It's, you know, I've met parents that they're just crying tears of joy when they see their kids able to start making eye contact with them. It's amazing stuff.
Well, at this point, I'd like to put a little commercial in for a video I just produced, which went up this afternoon at 3 o'clock, and already has over 1,400 views, dealing with the fact that it's actually patients talking about their experiences with it. So when I did the documentary, I was absolutely blown away, as was my cameraman, by how good medical marijuana does. If you want to see the video, it's on youtube.com/marijuanaoutlook. That's youtube.com/marijuanaoutlook. It is a devastating video to watch. Someone already emailed me saying that they were moved to tears. So I was just absolutely floored. I went on the medical marijuana board, a skeptic, and have become a convert. So I really believe in it, and that's why I have you on the program, Paul, because I want to spread the word, and your company, I think, will really help would-be entrepreneurs. So let's, having said my commercial, let's talk about you and your company and how you operate.
So the success of River Rock, Colorado, really has spawned this, and the two gentlemen that brought the key intellectual property to River Rock, Colorado, Ernie Blackman and Tony Vizzura. Ernie brings an unbelievably strong skill set of being able to cultivate the plant and has trained quite a few people to do so, and by that, the products have earned a worldwide reputation of being extremely effective. And with that said, Tony, very, very, very brilliant guy, has put together something that he named the ACT program, which is advanced cannabinoid therapies is what he's calling that. And with that, it's that program where they meet with patients and their doctors, and then, you know, come up with and these are things that are already on the shelf, but the cannabis-based products that are, you know, recommended to the patient that they take and to allow whatever ailment is troubling them to start, you know, whatever you want to call it, subsiding. You know, these things certainly have not yet gone through FDA testing, while a lot of companies such as ours have, you know, desire, you know, focuses in that area to go down that direction, as we recently brought on two PhDs that work out of the universities in Florida to start on the research and developing, identifying certain ailments where our products might be quite useful, and start driving those down towards the path to FDA testing. We're certainly not doing any FDA testing now, because it's obviously a long process, but we're setting the foundation for that. In addition, our company then will take our growing techniques and our techniques that we use to create these medicines, if you will, nutraceutical or medicines, however you want to identify them, and when we enter into a joint venture agreement with somebody, say in Nevada, we'll step in and we'll give them everything they need to be successful in the cannabis business, and that's from the part of cultivation, from the part of the making of the medicines, and the marketing of the company. And with that, United Cannabis Corporation also owns several brand names, and the key brand name, actually half a dozen we own, and one of those is the River Rock name. And so our goal is to also, you know, create a national brand under the River Rock name in this space. We've yet to identify really anybody that's in the cult, you know, is an end-to-end provider with a national brand. And so that's part of our goal. But in order to be a national brand, we're going to have to be providing a product and services that, you know, people are going to walk past other dispensaries to come and obtain. And this is something where, you know, we look to be spreading out throughout North America. That includes the U.S. and Canada. And we've even had dialogue with companies in, or potential partners in, other jurisdictions outside the United States. So we believe that we will be the first ones to really be that national brand.
So if someone was interested in talking to you or learning more about it?
Sure, they could reach out. Our website is unitedcannabis.us. You can go to info. You can also go to one of our press releases and call the contact number and reach out to us. And thus far, most of our jurisdictions or states that we're working in still have room for people that wish to enter the business. It's certainly something that it's going to require, you know, it's just like any business you go into, you know, people are going to be ready to work, and there's, you know, capital that will be need to be deployed depending on the size of the operation, which could be anywhere from the hundreds of thousands of dollars to, you know, $3-5 million, depending on the size of the grow facility, whether it's, you know, 10,000 square feet or 200,000 square feet. And and I would recommend, it's got to be somebody that really wants to be in the business and plan on being in it for quite a while.
Well, let's go back. My next question was going to be, what does it cost to enter a business like this?
It's really specific to the size of the facility. The first cost, of course, would be applying for your license. You could be looking at somewhere between $50,000 and $60,000. You need to have skilled counsel that's going to go in there and help you get the license and for prep work and in some jurisdictions you might want to consider somebody that's, you know, going to be working on a bit of a lobbying effort for you. Maybe not, you know, it depends on where you're working. Maybe in a place like Nevada, you're going to need to have somebody with some get some lawyers that have some really good contacts. If you're in maybe some wider open jurisdictions, that may be a cost that you may not have to bear. But it's safe to say that there's a lot of people buying to get in the business, and so it's going to, you know, it takes effort and some capital. And one of the things that is quite critical is, you know, when you walk in the door, they say, okay, we're going to give you a license. you know, what do you know about growing cannabis? And you're going to figure 90% of the people that are asked that question, they're going to say, well, nothing, you know, because it's been illegal since the 1930s. So that's where we step in and say, well, we're working with United Cannabis, and they've got the skills and the reputation and all the methodologies to make it, to help us be a successful operation. So there's, you know, there's some components there that all need to be in place, or people won't be able to get into business.
Well, let me ask you a question: if so many businesses went out in Colorado, has anyone thought of buying the license from them, or is that not possible?
In some instances, licenses are transferable. The applicant still would need to go through, you know, the entire background check associated with it. In Colorado, as an example, if you want to be part of a dispensary or a grow operation, you're going to have to pass this exact same background check as if you were trying to open up a casino here. So this is, you know, it's extremely thorough. And, you know, you really want to, you know, you're going to really want to get in this business, and it's doable. There's lots of people doing it, and lots of people making good money, but, you know, this is, you know, it takes sweat and effort to get this done.
Absolutely. I will tell you that I'll never worry about being blackmailed again, because my life
funny.
Was...
True,
was yes. My life was so thoroughly investigated back to my high school days. It was amazing what they had on me. A lot of which I had forgotten. So that is a big hurdle. And of course, having the money is a big hurdle. And there's another issue which people don't realize is that you can't deposit your receipts into most banks, and finding a bank that will accept the deposits and issue even a credit card, the ability to accept credit cards, is really fascinating. I've been talking to people all over the country, and they view that as their number two problem after raising the cannabis itself.
Go ahead.
Just in the last
week here in Colorado, the legislature, it was signed off by the governor to allow state banks to handle, you know, at least in a more legal fashion, allow state banks to handle the funds. This still has to be approved by the feds. You know, some people aren't given it a great chance for the federal government to approve it, and to certainly wait and see. There's definitely still banks that are handling the capital, but it's a very, very quiet, a situation. If you want, and it's probably the biggest secrets in the business are which state chartered banks are allowing those deposits. And it's not good to have somebody walking into a bank with backpack full of capital because they weren't able to process credit cards and make the banking process safer. So there's some very interesting dynamics going on the whole business, and especially as you're pointing out here in the money side of things, it's a bit of a dance.
Well, there's another interesting angle to this is that the federal government is federal and state are taking taxes, and just today in the federal court in D.C. a suit was filed by an attorney for a dispensary claiming that the federal government had no right to tax the profits or the monies of the marijuana growers in states where it's legal, and the court accepted the case. I don't think they have much chance of escaping that. We in New Jersey, in mind, we're a nonprofit, still give 30% of every dollar we collect to the federal government in the form of taxes. That's another wrinkle that I think is really funny and interesting.
It's extremely interesting, and it's a bit of a mess, really. And at some point in time, this all needs to be sorted out in a way. And once it is, the ability to regulate it in a proper fashion will be much easier, because right now it's just a bit of a mishmash of rules that are applied, and some of them are helpful and some of them are quite harmful, and the collision of state and local governments, are they medicines, are they prescriptions, are they nutraceuticals? I mean, there's a lot of things that need to be worked out here, but I think the first thing we need to do is that cannabis needs to be taken off as a Schedule I narcotic. It's technically classified to be more harmful than something like cocaine, which is a Schedule II. It's mind-numbing.
Yeah, yes, it is extremely interesting. The Chinese have an expression, "May you live in interesting times," and this is certainly one of them when it comes to this. But the other question I have is obviously in making a decision to go into the business, someone must realize that they are essentially breaking a federal law. And
no question about it. No question about it. That is something that someone needs to consider. Certainly guidance has come down from the federal government, but they're going to operate hands-off, and they just want people to follow the rules set forth by the state, which I think is a great start. But at some time, we these policies need to be hand-in-hand and cohesive, so everybody's on the same page.
Well, as someone that just emailed me now, what happens if in 2 years when we have a new president, that president decides to invest require enforcement of the laws, what's going to happen then?
You know what? The real answer to that question is we'll find out. We will find out when it happens. The general consensus is that for the polls that I've read and the opinions out there, that the majority of the country wants to see it legalized. There's for multiple reasons. You've got tens of thousands of people sitting in prisons for marijuana-related offenses, And I think Colorado's got 10,000 sitting in jail right now as a result of it. How much money would the state save if all those people were no longer sitting in jail? And, I'm sure it's tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars is costing the state to confine and house all those people. And magnify that on a federal level and state by state. Now we're talking about billions of dollars that can be saved. Billions. And I'm sure a lot of these people were nonviolent offenders and could come back into the fold of society and be productive people.
Well, we always hope that. I wonder what the various Mexican cartels, et cetera, are thinking right now. Are they switching their product to other drugs, or no one knows the answer to that except maybe the DEA or some government agency. But it's again the other side of the coin. In the meantime, what I've seen, and I'm sure you've seen as well, is the good that medical marijuana does for the people that it can help. Interesting side note, there's two studies out of Israel and one out of France recently, and on my video, was an elderly gentleman who started taking, who had end-stage cancer, stage 3 cancer, I think. And he said that since he started taking the marijuana, the cancer cells have actually shrunk, the cancer areas, and two studies in Israel show that as well. The French one, the results were less clear, but still indicative, as they said in the study. So I don't want and people, listeners, to rush off and say that they heard it, but there is some evidence that medical marijuana can help in those stages in certain diseases.
Your listeners could go as an example to River Rock, Colorado, which I want to make perfectly clear. The only thing that United Cannabis Corporation and River Rock, Colorado share is intellectual property. Ernie and Tony are owners of that, but United Cannabis is a separate company from them. There's no shared revenue, nothing like that. But if someone were to go to the River Rock, Colorado website and click on the Learn button, and you'll see patient stories there where people are giving, unguided testimonials. These are just people speaking from the heart about their experiences with cannabis and what it's done for their health. I think that'd be very beneficial for some people to watch the testimonials and hear what those patients have to say about themselves. Pretty eye-opening testimony from these people that have been on it, and how it's made their, in their opinions, life much, much better, and sometimes they believe that they're alive because of it.
Well, we're conducting a study in association with three hospitals at our dispensary, and where we're taking a reduction in pain and measuring that. When a patient comes in, they fill out a form, and after 3 months, we ask them to fill out that form again and at three-month intervals. And so far, the results have been over 90% report some improvement. It varies, but it's still some improvement. And you can't ask for a better testimonial. Paul, before we let you go, again, your site?
So we're unitedcannabis.us, www.unitedcannabis.us. So you can learn about us there and find ways to contact us. Our trading symbol, which is on the OTCQB, which is CNAB, and the official name is United Cannabis Corporation.
Okay.
So that's CNAB, as in Charlie, Nancy, Apple, Bravo.
That's really good to know. Again, Paul, thank you for coming on, and I think we're going to invite Tony to come on sometime in the near future and continue this discussion.
I think your audience will be fascinated with the insight that, I know they'll be fascinated with the insight and information that Tony would bring to the table. You've got more of the business side for me after you hear from Tony. He'll talk about the medical side and really amazing stuff.
Well, that we are a business site, but I couldn't. When I first talked with you yesterday, I just felt that you should be on the program, and I'm so glad you came. Thank you.
I'm glad you invited me.
We'll talk again.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
If anyone in the audience wants to see this video on medical marijuana and its effect, it's www.youtube.com/marijuanaoutlook. It's a really terrific video. And really thank you, Paul, again for coming.
Thank you.
Our next guest is Nick Fishman. He's Vice President of Employee Screen IQ, and he's here today because I ran into an interesting situation a couple of weeks ago. A company called us and said that they had hired an individual from India, and when they brought him over, they discovered that his credentials were all false, but they had spent a great deal of money. And over the last couple of weeks, I found that other companies have faced the same problem. So I went to one of the bigger background screening companies, Employee Screen IQ, and I was lucky enough to get Nick Fishman, vice president of the company, to come on board and talk about background screening in general and background when screening when you're talking about someone from overseas. But as we do with every guest, we first ask them to tell us a little bit about themselves. Nick, welcome to the program, and the floor is all yours.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. As you mentioned, we've been here at Employee Screen IQ for about 15 years now, serving clients of all sizes, primarily mid to large size organizations, over 3,000 of them across the country and around the world. It's been a big passion of mine for years now, and I'm happy to join you.
Well, Nick, I'm glad you did because, as I say, here's a company that spent thousands of dollars trying to identify an engineer that they could bring on board into a highly specialized, only to find out when he arrived and after less than 3 weeks on the job that his credentials were false, or let's put it this way, considerably exaggerated, and he certainly didn't have the knowledge that they had hoped for. So having said that, Nick, what could a small business do to avoid this situation again?
Well, the number one thing that they could have done ahead of time is to conduct proper due diligence before they extended the job offer and certainly before they brought the individual over from India. And the way that they could go about doing that is to, in fact, perform an employment and education verification, which would certify the credentials that the candidate had represented. That takes place in a number of different ways. I mean, as far as education is concerned, the candidate would simply tell you where they got their degree from, and they would provide you in India, they require what's called a seat number. It's the closest thing that we have to a Social Security number. And once we have that seat number, it would allow us to go ahead and verify that they did, in fact, receive the degree that they claim to have received from the university that they said that they received it from. As far as employment verifications are concerned, the candidate would provide, as I'm sure that they did in this case, with their resume and indicate where they have worked over the course of their career. And again, performing a simple employment verification where you contact past employers and you ask all types of questions, anything from providing reassurance that the person did in fact work there and attaining their dates of employment, and then also, of course, asking what type of responsibilities they had with their job. While not as easy to ascertain that information in the United States, where many employers are well-versed and used to this type of request, at a minimum, you do get the fact that these people will confirm that the person worked there and what their responsibilities are. Beyond that, sometimes you can get starting and ending salary. Sometimes you can get an interview with the supervisor about their performance. But at the very least, you're going to be able to confirm that they actually work there, and that should have helped in this situation.
Very definitely. But do you, for instance, if that company had hired your company, do you have people there that actually go and do that? Do you have people on the ground there to do that?
Yeah, so we actually have relationships in 200 different countries. As far as what types of services are available on a country-to-country basis, all of them have some type of criminal record component where we have resources in those countries that are searching the best source available to get that information. Okay. So sometimes it's a police station, sometimes it's a courthouse. It's a little bit different in every country. As far as the employment verifications are concerned, they can be done in a variety of places. Sometimes they're performed in country. Sometimes they're performed by folks that just are experts in that language and know how to reach out. So it varies by country. In India, our work is actually done on when I say on site, it's done in country.
Well, how much does a service like this cost for someone overseas?
So you know, the prices will vary for criminal background checks. Just based on done on a country by country basis. From a verification standpoint, you're typically looking at anywhere between $75 and $100 to be able to confirm verification, and $75 to $100 to be able to confirm past employment on a per employer basis.
So for a little under $200, they could have saved a lot of heartache.
They could have, yeah. You know, again, the education verification is a slam dunk. They would have known right away whether he actually, you know, graduated from that school, what his degree was in. As far as the employment verification, it could have gone either way. They, you know, perhaps they would have spoken with somebody and they would have just confirmed dates of employment, or if they made it, if the individual made it up altogether, that they even worked in a specific place, they would have known that as well.
You know, it's extraordinary. I've talked to this company, and they're fairly sophisticated, but in researching this story, I've come across a lot of other companies that didn't realize they could get such verification, particularly overseas. Do you find that common?
We certainly find it common among small businesses that might not have, I hate to say sophistication because that makes it seem like small business, they don't have the wherewithal. It's just that they don't realize that they have the resources available to them to be able to do it. With most large and mid-sized organizations, they understand that those resources are available to them. They know how to access that information, and it's become fairly standard. In fact, it would be abnormal not to do it. With small businesses, they just need to realize that there are resources out there, that they can do it, and that they should do it. And, again, with small businesses, you know, they can't afford to make these types of hiring mistakes. Unfortunately, this company that you're talking about probably spent a lot of time and a lot of money recruiting this person, bringing them over, putting them to work, only to find out that it didn't work out for them. And, you know, you have to certainly feel bad for the situation that they were in. And, you know, hopefully, you know, I'm sure that they've learned a lesson that if they were to do it again, that there are resources ample out there to be able to help them with their decision.
Well, I learned from another provider, a screening provider, that in India, when they do a background check, they find that 40% of the resumes they check are less than truthful.
I apologize for cutting you off. Yeah, what I was going to tell you is that we actually have a 50% discrepancy rate between what a candidate reports about their past and what we find when we actually perform the verification work. And that's not necessarily a bunch of people out there lying about their qualifications. Oftentimes it's dates of employment, it's starting and ending salary, but every once in a while you will find people that are blatantly lying about their qualifications, and that's our job to kind of track those down and highlight those for employers.
Well, let's turn it domestically for a little bit. You do a lot of verification domestically. Do you also find that people expand their resume, or I'm trying to think of a nice, polite way of saying
that they take liberties?
Yes.
Yeah. So it varies by the industry that you're screening for and the country that you're screening in, and so the more sophisticated the country is, the more used to background checks they are, the less you see them blatantly lying, because they know that employers will do these things. I think where you find it more blatantly internationally is when they're not as well versed in background checks, and it's not as commonly held of a practice. And so that's where we see, you know, the more blatant lies occurring.
Well, here in the United States, obviously we're more sophisticated and more used to it. Do you still see a rate of discrepancy?
Yeah, and I would say that our country is an aberration in that example. I think that the example I provided is really good internationally. In the U.S., people continue to fabricate their resumes, whether they're doing it intentionally or whether it's just embellishment here. Again, like I said, about 50% of the resume verification work that we do we find that somebody has in some way, shape, or form misrepresented their past, either education or academic or employment qualifications.
Even here in the United States?
Absolutely, yep.
Boy, that astonishes me.
Yeah, and we recently did a survey of approximately 600 employers across the United States, and we asked how often, when they identify that a person has lied on their resume, how often is the person not getting hired? And the greatest portion of our respondents, I don't remember what the actual percentage number was, but they said that 90% of the time, they're not hiring the person that's fabricated their resume. So it's not doing anybody all that much good to lie on their resume, because if they get caught, by and large, they're not getting hired.
That's really extraordinary. The number, I'm a little aghast. I would think that people in this day and age would realize that it's so easy to check on a lot of stuff. One thing I love about this program, I learned so much from my guests, and thank you. Should a small business hire someone like you for all hires? Let me put it this way. How much do you charge here in the United States for education and criminal background?
So the numbers vary, and they vary based on the amount of background checks that you're performing on behalf of a particular client, and what types of services that they're doing. You know, I would tell you that you know, a criminal background check will cost an employer anywhere from $30 up to about $100. It just totally depends on the number of jurisdictions that you're searching, and it actually could be less than that as well. You know, so if folks have only lived in one county, for instance, and they've only gone by one name, you know, perhaps that background check will cost you $10. But it varies by the number of counties where they've lived, because if you're doing a background check correctly, you're actually performing an in-person search of the county courthouse where that person lived in each one of the counties that are identified on their address history search. You're also performing that search under each name that they've gone by, because courts most commonly are filing records by the person's name that was used at the time that they committed the crime, and most often their date of birth. More and more courts are now removing Social Security numbers from court records. So that's the best way to identify whether somebody has a criminal record or not. And as far as employment and education verifications are concerned, you know, general rule of thumb is anywhere between, you know, maybe $9 per employer up to maybe $12 per employer, and the same, you know, variability of rates for education verifications.
Hmm. Well, you know, there's been talk about banning employers from not hiring because someone has a criminal record, which I find extraordinary, because I'd hate to hire someone with a criminal record. That hasn't gone that far, as I understand, but it's still something on the horizon. What will happen then?
Well, all of the legislation that's come out now is not a blanket mandate to hire people with criminal records. What it is it's a mandate to say that you don't have a blanket policy to eliminate all candidates if you find a criminal record. They want you to basically look at the type of record that you found on an applicant, which employers by and large do. They want you to look at the severity of that record. How long ago did it occur? How does it relate to the job that the person is applying for? Is the person a repeat offender? All kinds of things like that. And those are things that are fair to do because, obviously, let's say that you've got somebody that doesn't have any type of driving responsibility, for instance, yet perhaps they were convicted of a DUI 10 years ago, and the question is whether that should haunt them for the rest of their lives. If they're applying for a position that requires driving, maybe that's more important than it is for a position that doesn't. So there is no blanket mandate out there, nor is there a movement to completely eliminate the use of criminal records in employment decisions. They just want you to use them responsibly.
Well, that's good to hear, because, I totally misunderstood what the legislation was going to do, and I'm glad you cleared it up, at least for me, and I'm sure for our audience.
That is a common misconception. The most influential of all of these guidelines, if you will, was introduced by the EEOC in 2012. That was the biggest concern, is that employers feared that that's what that guidance would say. It does not say that, but it is a misconception. So you're not the only one.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. The other thing is that the governmental agencies are cracking down if you're hiring undocumented aliens. How does one use your service or others to make sure that whoever they're hiring is legally entitled to work in the United States?
Sure. So that what you're describing is the right to work verification. And that is a process that is conducted after a person has been hired, in which the same process that's existed for years is still in effect. The person has to fill out an I-9 form. The good news is these days there are electronic I-9 forms that can be filled out, and it can be automatically submitted to the Social Security Administration. And in the case of somebody that is on a visiting work permit, or not a legal resident but has a right to work in this country, it would go to the Department of Homeland Security. And once that information is confirmed and it can be done in a matter of seconds, you have a confirmation that they have a right to work. There are a number of ways to streamline that process as opposed to just having somebody fill out an I-9 and it's sitting on the shelf until you're notified that somebody is an undocumented worker.
You've given us a heck of a lot of good information. How can people reach your company and you?
Thank you. Yeah, so best way to reach us is going to our website at www.employeescreen.com. That's employeescreen.com. That's the best way to check us out. Find out all the resources we have between our blog and our university, in which we're educating employers out there about how to use background checks, what are the latest trends, what is the latest legislation, and how to stay in compliance.
What final advice would you give our audience? Almost 59% of our audience are presidents and or owners. What advice would you give them?
What we see, the advice I would give is what we see among small businesses is that they are more trusting of candidates than they probably should be. They don't realize that they have resources and that they should be conducting background checks. So the first step is you need to be conducting background checks on all employees that you hire. Unfortunately, one bad hiring decision can really cost you, whether it's due to criminal activity in the workplace or just it doesn't work out and you have to go back to square one. So step number one is performing the background check. Step number two is making sure that you're an educated buyer. There are a lot of people out there that are offering so-called background checks for $5 on the Internet where you get your results immediately. Unfortunately, that's not an effective way to determine whether somebody has a criminal record. So make sure you understand what is involved in the search. And number three, make sure that you understand what the laws are. You need consent in order to conduct a background check. The applicant has to give you permission to run that background check. And in the event you decide not to hire them, there's a process that you have to follow and notifications that you have to be able to provide to the applicant if you decide not to hire them. So those are the three main points of advice that I have for your audience.
Wow. Thank you, Nick. I really appreciate that you've been on, because I've learned a lot, and I hope our audience as well, and I hope I can invite you back again for another go-round.
It would be my pleasure, and I'm happy to do it.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening tonight. All of our guests are invited because they offer actionable advice to our audience. They do not pay to join us, but rather demonstrate their capacity for helping our audience add profits. Thank you for listening, and we'll be here again next week with other experts to talk about ways to improve your profit picture. Remember, we're here every week at blogtalkradio.com/smallbusinessdigest. If you like what you heard today, tell others about our efforts. If you would like to be a guest or suggest topics for future hours, email me at info@smallbusinessdigest.net. That's info@smallbusinessdigest.net. We would also like to remind listeners that besides our radio efforts, Small Business Digest comes to you via the web, through our video channel, and in our magazine. You can subscribe for any or all of these by going to smallbusinessdigest.net. That's smallbusinessdigest.net. Thank you, and have a good day.